recognize the diagnostics program he was running. Not a huge surprise. She knew a lot about computers, alternate operating systems, and was a fair coder in more than one program language. But Raoul was in a league all his own. A few years back, he'd won a cash prize at a hacker conference for being the first to find a critical bug in a popular laptop model. A year later, he won another prize for demonstrating how the leading browser could be owned simply by directing it to a web page loaded with malware. Making a living by publicly demonstrating how other people's top-selling products were actually piles of dog shit was a great way to make enemies. Raoul had received more than one anonymous threat. As their volume and vehemence grew, his peace of mind disintegrated. He'd finally gone into hiding, certain his name was on some secret NSA file or corporate hit list targeted for elimination or something. Kate doubted that men in dark glasses would ever show up to haul Raoul away. Then again, after what she'd witnessed 2 nights ago, her confidence in the definition of realistic was shaken. Maybe she'd been wrong to doubt the man's convictions. Maybe he knew deeper truths about the way things worked than she needed to discover. Raoul tapped more keys. Data streamed across the screen. They'd met before she'd left Microsoft at a tech conference. Raoul might have had romantic intentions, but nothing ever came of it. After she'd started her own business and Raoul had gone to ground, they kept in touch. She received an email with a coded phrase letting her know who it was every time he moved into new digs, which was at least twice a year. "Anything?" she said. She could see the screen as well as Raoul, but she must have been reading it wrong because... "Yes and no. There's a lot of data here. Terabytes, which is unheard of for such a small package." Whoa. She hadn't been reading the screen wrong. "How many terabytes?" "That's another thing. I can't actually tell. The profiler is still estimating the drive size." She studied the end protruding from Raoul's computer. Plugged in, it looked out of place. Alien. She crossed her arms. "Are you sure it's safe?" she said. "So far, it's still encrypted. Can you break it?"
"We'll see. I started running dictionaries against it."
She cocked her head.
"That could take a while. Have you tried Monkey?"
Monkey was the most used password, statistics showed. People who chose it thought they were being clever. They weren't. Just predictable.
"Of course," said Raoul.
He grinned, probably at the foolishness of noobs everywhere. But his smile faded. After a few minutes, he said,
"This isn't working. If the password was easily guessable, we would have had something by now. Which means it's probably secure."
"I was afraid of that," said Kate. "In time, any password could be cracked. But the more complex the password, the longer the search. Throw in an uppercase letter or some punctuation, and most importantly, increase the encryption key size, and even a massive cracking array making billions of guesses a second would take centuries." She summed it up.
"Well then, we're probably screwed."
He shrugged.
"Give me a little credit, Michula. I've got more tricks up my sleeve."
Every so often, Kate wondered what Michula meant. It was a pet name, of course, but she hadn't given Raoul the satisfaction of asking for its definition or checking the internet herself. Instead, she said, "Those tricks are why I called you."
"See that?"
Raoul pointed to one of the open windows on his screen. Data from captured traffic filled it. She said, "I've seen a few of those terms, but I'm not sure what this means." Raoul tapped the flash drive, then raised his eyebrows expectantly, as if waiting for her to get the punchline.
"Wait," Kate said. "Is the flash drive doing that?"
"Yes. As soon as it mounted, it began requesting network access. I've blocked it."
"Well, who's it trying to call?"
She thought of Jason, then imagined Cold War bunkers filled with flesh-melting chemicals.
"I don't know," said Raoul. "Yet. But if we let it try to make the connection, I may capture enough data to break the encryption.
That sounds stupidly dangerous. Do you remember when I said the man I met died? It wasn't normal. I think he might have been murdered.
I remember. I was worried that was exactly what you meant. She sighed.
I haven't told you everything, Raoul, and I don't intend to for your own peace of mind. This little USB drive scares me. I can reformat it, wipe it clean. Then it won't be anyone's problem anymore.
Want me to take it off your hands?
Kate considered his offer. Part of her wanted to tell Raoul to do it quickly before she thought better of it.
No, it's important. I just don't know why. As much as I'd rather just trash it and walk away, I need to know what's on it, where it came from, and why that man died.
Then we have to accept some risk.
Hearing you say that is sort of funny.
Raoul chuckled, obviously appreciating her point. Kate liked a man who was able to laugh at his own foibles.
The process won't have free rein. I'll keep it sandboxed, but it needs enough leeway so that the process believes it's actually making a connection.
Kate felt like she was on a roller coaster cresting a steep rise, getting her first view of the screaming drop ahead.
All right, she said. Do it.
Raoul tapped a key. Chapter 7 Sovereign Elendine, Queen of Hazurium. Sword in hand, Elendine walked the borders of the Strange under a red sun. So close to the edge, the light seemed old and used up. Beneath her boots, the land was convulsed. Long ruts dragged scars down to the west, as if made by the monstrous talons of a colossal stranger unable to retain its grip on Ardeen. The occasional cactus and thorny tree drooped, wilted with pestilence. The splintered landscape was Ardeen's boundary, where only the insane or suicidal trespassed. Beyond it drifted a sporadic scatter of free-floating skerries like barnacles on reality's border. And beyond them lay the Strange. She rarely glanced that way. Elendine traveled a path parallel to the chaos that spurned all rules, not into it. The Strange would not try her strength, not today. The Maker willing, it never would. Her sword was potent enough. It held an enchantment for slaying and had a secret name only she knew. Rincewandir. But Rincewandir was nothing compared to the chaos beyond the world. Not even her ring, which outclassed her sword by no small margin, would avail her there. The ring had seen better days, but it was still equal to most trials contained in Ardeen. It had another name once, when it was mighty. Now it was called Peace. Elendine had peace from her mother, who got it from her mother before her, and so on all the way back. The ring was a relic of the founding. Without it, the Queendom of Hazurium would have crumbled ages ago, as opposed to merely sliding into senility over generations. Perhaps it was finally happening, and the Queendom would fall. After all, how else could she explain her sister Flora's death?
Elendine, said Navarre.
The queen glanced round, blinking away nascent tears. Navarre's jackal visage was fixed on a nearby cave, tall ears forward. Navarre sat on a silver-maned Lorne charger, the giant breed famously foaled in the easternmost fiefdom of Hazurium. Navarre's kind were sometimes feared for the exploits of her shadow kin, the Sark. Sark were Kephalem, who rebelled against the Seven Rules, but as the first protector, Navarre had shown herself to be a more loyal defender than any other, including even Elendine's own mother. The first protector was also something of a friend. Seeing she had Elendine's attention, Navarre gestured to the right of their path. A cavern gaped there. The queen glanced at the dripping cave mouth, partly hidden in the folds of earth and foliage, no more than a stone's throw away. She'd been paying too much attention to the regrets lined up inside her skull to notice the cavity. Where there's a cave, there's almost certain a creature's lair. That wasn't one of the vaunted 7 rules, but it might as well have been. You've got a keen eye, Protector, Ellendine said. I'll call for your mount. The knight raised a hand to signal the courtiers and guards making up the queen's detail following behind. She said, let's move away from here. No, said Ellendine, we should search the cave. Brandolin's trail led here. Navarre snorted. Trust me, your majesty. Brandolin detests caves. I served as her protector for 12 good years before you. She wouldn't enter a place like that. Ellendine recalled growing up in the vaulted halls of Citadel Hazurium, and how her mother couldn't abide a dark room. Every chamber had at least 4 lamps for light, and most far more. The queen loved her mother, but Brandolin had made a shambles of an already bad situation. She had ignored her duties too long, in favor of the increasingly single-minded pursuits contrived by what some claimed, in whispers, to be a doddering imagination. After her mother's abdication, Ellendine took the vows of rulership. She became the ruler of Hazurium. She had inherited a queendom under threat of an alliance of Shadow Kephalem, the Cray, and the Betrayer. That eel-cuddling Betrayer was probably behind the whole thing. If Ellendine the Young didn't prove more apt at her duties than Brandolin the Distracted, it would be under her watch that every human still alive in the refuge of Ardeen would become extinct. The 7 rules codified by the Maker would finally break, and the endless chaos outside the world would wash it all away. Aloud she said, Navarre, you knew her before she entered her dotage. Who really knows her thoughts now, and if she still fears the dark? The first protector's ears twitched, first one, then the other. Ellendine had learned that meant uncertainty, but Navarre said, Brandolin would have headed away from that cave, past the edges of Ardeen, most likely to find fragments of that blasted device she was always going on about, begging your pardon, my queen. Ellendine said, unless a Sirish or dragon caught her and her traitorous guards napping and pulled them all into its den against their will. All right, I yield, said Navarre. But after we check the cave, we must return to Citadel Hazurium. You made me promise to hold you to a deadline on this outing, and we've come close to missing it. Ellendine nodded impatiently. Ardeen's previous ruler was nowhere to be found, having apparently undertaken a self-appointed quest to find the parts for a mystical mechanism. A mechanism she learned about via a vision sent from the Maker. Ellendine didn't believe it for a heartbeat. It was more likely Brandolin had simply been unable to face her youngest daughter Flora's demise. Either way, it wouldn't do the queendom any favors if Brandolin's inheritor was seen following in her mother's footsteps. Flora, she blinked away the thought before it could take root. Ellendine said, don't worry about the deadline. Look, see that scary out there? The one with the attending red tumblers? I've been watching it, and I think that once we clear the cave, we— We'll miss Flora's internment, interrupted Navarre. Ellendine froze. Then she shrugged. Is that what this is really all about? Asked the Kephalem. I can understand why. You know I do. But others may see it differently. Besides, Flora would have— Ellendine spun to face the first protector. Don't you dare tell me what Flora would want. Do you think I don't know? Do you think I don't care? It's not for you or anyone to judge me. Keep to your place, Protector, and all of us will be better for it. Navarre stiffened in her saddle, and her ebony ears laid back almost flat against her black-furred skull. The knight turned to regard the cave mouth again. She waited a moment and said, As it pleases your majesty. Which only made Ellendine all the more furious. She yelled, It
doesn't please me. My sister died, and all the royal power in Ardeen can't change that."
After that, words deserted her entirely. Rather than sputter, Elendine just glared at the First Protector, half hoping Navarre would offer some additional fuel for her fury. Being angry felt better than being heartlorn. Instead, Navarre called behind for the captain of the Queen's detail and a contingent of 4 soldiers to search the cave. "Watch for crawlers," she instructed the captain. 5 soldiers shuffled into the cavity, one with a lantern, 2 with spell staves called rune ashers, and 2 with glittering swords. Elendine clasped her rage close. If she could keep that coal burning, images of Flora wouldn't swim up from the depths. Flora, who loved to write poetry. Flora, riding behind her through Mellis Forest at dawn, a grin plastered across her face as they evaded the royal escort. Flora, who was the only one who could make Brandolin laugh with her awkward puns. Flora, gasping in the healer's hall of Citadel Hazurium, her pain so extreme that she shuddered almost constantly, so that she hardly knew Elendine. The numbing influence of green wasp venom brought only momentary relief, and the royal soul mancer offered no hope. When Flora's end finally claimed her, and she passed over, it was almost a relief, because her suffering was over. Elendine was bereft and alone without her younger sister, and her emotional barriers were tumbled to ruin. Laura died almost a month ago, and her spirit had descended into the Night Vault. But, as was proper on the 33rd day following death of anyone in Hazurium, the deceased remains would be interred west of Citadel Hazurium, in the Great Wall called Ur. A funeral celebration would follow. By any estimation, Elendine should be there. When someone was interred in Ur, the Queen should be on hand to say a few words. If that someone was the Queen's sister, unthinkable that the Queen should miss it, but that's exactly what Elendine decided to do. Whenever she let her guard down, she was ambushed by the singular memory of her sister's passing, literally in her arms, in the brightly lit healing hall that smelled of candles and medicine. All Flora's limbs had loosened in a slow but unstoppable wave before a stillness more silent than the deepest sleep settled over her. After that, Elendine had only tears and recollections, moments that played over and over. Time would heal her heart, she was assured by those stupid enough to brave her grief and rage, but after 31 days the wound was just as raw. It was all she could do not to think about it and focus on retrieving her mother instead. By the Maker, if Brandolin wasn't around to attend the internment, then neither would Elendine. One of the soldiers assigned to explore the cave emerged. He sauntered up to Navarre and said, "The cave holds the rotting corpse of Asurish, dead for a month, maybe more, nothing else." "Dead?" said the First Protector. "Any sign of what killed it?" The man shrugged. Elendine frowned at the disrespect the soldier showed the First Protector. Plus, something tough enough to slay Asurish should warrant something more than a shrug. She stepped up to the man, checked his insignia, then demanded, "Captain," answered the Protector's question. "What killed Asurish? Where's the rest of your detail?" The captain's head swung her way, a bit jerkily. She said, "The others are becoming acquainted with their new shells, and yes, we've found what killed the beast. It's with me now." Pale stalks parted the man's hair, folding out from his head, questing like fingers. "Cray!" shouted Navarre. The captain was gone. He'd been hollowed out and worn like a hat, just long enough to gestate a cray. The cray-wearing captain vomited a colorless gout of webbing. Elendine evaded the twining strands. Anything cocooned in it was changed or entirely removed from Ardeen. She came up on the cray's left and hacked off 2 emerging stalks with her blade, then dispatched the cray with a straight thrust before it completely emerged. Her relic breastplate, for all its sturdiness, was also wound with spells that made it almost as light as a simple shift. The Maker is merciful, she thought, providing a distraction from thinking about funerals. Where there was one Kray, more would follow. Three more soldiers clambered from the cave, moving with suspicious awkwardness. Navarre rode two down in a brutal display of horsemanship, but the third jumped away. The Kray inside that last walking corpse was almost completely free, and when it stood up, it was on crab-like legs instead of human feet. 2.5 times as tall as its dead host, pincers with spinnerets at the tips aimed at the first protector as she wheeled her mount. Elendine raised the ring called Peace and called on its only remaining function. She wasn't close enough to distinguish between Navarre and the Kray, so all were engulfed in a dim haze of tranquility that slowed thoughts, hearts, and even time. Outside Ardine, the ring had little power over the Kray, but by entering the world, they bound themselves to Ardine's rules. So Peace snagged the stranger as surely as if it was a native. Elendine rushed to close the distance. She had just seconds to end the fight. The Kray jerked back to awareness. It swung the hollowed man that had birthed it like a bludgeon. Elendine was knocked sprawling, her head rattling against a boulder. She scrambled to regain her feet, but everything was spinning. The thing advanced, holding the dead husk high, ready to strike again. Elendine gasped. "Motherless son of Lotan, get away from me!" A thunder of hooves heralded the remainder of her detail. 20-some soldiers strong, they rode the last Kray down. Rune ashers inscribed with potent enough sigils were deadly against most strangers, but halberds, swords, and hooves did just fine, too. What remained after the charge was only a mess. "Your Majesty," yelled Navarre as she rode up, "are you hurt?" "No," Elendine said, and stood. "Truthfully, I haven't felt this fine in days." She wished more than 4 Kray had emerged from the cave, but the fight seemed done. Navarre said, "Let's have the physician take a look, shall we?" "In a moment," Elendine said, "after we make certain nothing else infests that hole." "How in the Maker's name did they get across the border this time?" The Queen shrugged. "They have a knack for bending the 7 rules. Or they paid or tricked someone into opening a door, however small." Navarre looked thoughtful. She said, "There's so many choices. One of the betrayers, homunculi, a wandering devil, a saboteur from the Court of Sleep, or just some poor wanderer who strayed too close to the edge." "Eh, the answer might be any of those or just a surge out of the strange." Elendine frowned. The elation from the fight was fading, though not yet completely gone. "In any event, this represents a serious intrusion, wouldn't you agree?" Elendine said. The First Protector nodded. "Of course, the region could be compromised. It would be foolhardy to ignore this. Not all of us need to return for the interment." "None of us will attend," Elendine interrupted, "especially me." She raised the Ring of Peace so Navarre couldn't miss it. Peace was their most potent weapon against strangers. In fact, once the physician had her say, "I'll lead a sortie." Her eyes focused fully on Peace. Instead of its normal golden hue, the ring was red as blood. It had never done that before. Then it chimed. Completely new behavior, too. Sound rolled across the landscape, the chain on which she normally wore it parted and slipped to the ground. Elendine nearly dropped it in surprise. "Did you do that?" said Navarre. "No." Elendine studied the ring. Brandolin used to tell her stories about Peace. The Maker had given each incarnation a mighty weapon in the form of a ring, a sort of manifestation of their abilities. Elendine was descended from one of those incarnations, if family histories could be believed. Elendine never had. The story had it that when the Maker was betrayed, the rings lost most of their strength. The incarnations became mortal, and the age of myth ended, ushering in the age of unrest. Brandlin had sometimes wondered if the rings would someday remember some of their ancient power when, not if, the Maker returned. Peace was one of those rings, though it started with a different name. When first forged, its power was more fell and feared. The Ring of Death, it had been named. Death had the power to slay whosoever the wielder chose and raise back from death anyone the wielder touched. Elendine said, "It's clear some measure of the ring's old power has returned." Her plan crystallized in a moment. The queen slid the ring onto her right index finger. It settled as comfortably as if she'd always worn it there instead of on a chain around her neck. "Navarre," she said, "I've changed my mind. We must leave the borderlands. Thank the Maker we're close to where we need to be." "Your Majesty?" "I aim to see my sister smile again." Chapter 8 Reconciliation, Carter Morrison. The phone from the plastic bin had an address and phone number for Michael Bradley. When I called my old friend, Bradley didn't pick up. I didn't leave a message. An electronic fob with a Chevrolet logo meant my benefactor had probably left me with wheels. My benefactor. A funny concept, considering that he was me, right? The thing was, I certainly didn't remember arranging for this storage unit. I wasted a minute trying to remember it anyway. Then I opened the garage door a crack and peered outside. A normal Seattle day waited for me, complete with familiar skyscrapers on the skyline, clouds and drizzle. No sirens, no columns of smoke, or any other signs of planetivores claiming another moat in the normal universe as their own. I breathed easier. Surprised I hadn't already, I checked the date on the phone. 3 years. 3 years had passed. Jesus! For me, it seemed like only minutes. What happened in all that time? Especially in the dark energy network we'd touched after I'd returned the second time. It was a blank, as if whatever had happened to somebody else. The Ardeen release poster came off the garage door with a few gentle tugs, and I began to roll it up. Thinking better, I laid it on the floor to study it one more time. Ardeen, land of the cursed. In the fiction of the game, Citadel Hazirium was a central bastion in a land cursed to be the literal prison for Lotan, the Reaper of Sins, our mythical Big Bad. Keflin, my word for angelic beings, of all sorts, lived on above and beneath Ardeen, including Lotan's celestial jailers, the Keflim, who made up the Court of Sleep. The Court of Sleep, in turn, answered to demigods called the incarnations of the Maker who watched over Ardeen from the Maker's Hall. I shook my head. The important thing was the poster, and my handwriting on it. Its presence implied at minimum that I'd come back here after trying to download into Ardeen, except I didn't actually remember anything like that. Had I fallen into some kind of hibernation and only awakened now in the garage? But then why the poster? Why my handwriting? No, the implication was that my frantic upload of Ardeen to the network had worked and that I'd gone there, even if I couldn't bring it to mind. And then, had I printed myself back to Earth a second time? Why? Maybe only an instance of me had printed back here, if that was possible. Maybe I was that instance. Jesus. Regardless, the poster was a cryptic message from myself. It's how I would have done it. If some random stranger had entered, the poster's significance and short note would be completely opaque. It was a contingency I had set up as some sort of failsafe. I just wish I knew what I'd been thinking when I'd done so. I called Bradley again. The same recorded voice picked up. "Hey,
I can't come to the phone right now. You know what to do. This time, I said after the beep, "Hey, Bradley, it's me. Sorry about the toolbox to the head thing." "Yeah. Hey, apparently you have something for me. I don't remember what. Anyway, I'm heading over to your place." A canary-yellow Camaro waited under the dusty tarp. I'd never been a sports car guy, but on the drive over to Bradley's, I realized that was maybe because I'd just never had the opportunity. Now wasn't the time to check out the car's ability to handle at top speed, but driving it put me somehow in a better mood. Bradley still rented a tiny house in Queen Anne, a neighborhood northwest of downtown. It was the safe part of the city. But I didn't like seeing that his door was ajar. Since he still wasn't answering his phone, I crept in through the front door, quiet as a cat. Tumbled books, overturned furniture, and liberated pillow stuffing covered the front room. The scene fit my movie-bred expectations for the aftermath of a home invasion. Swallowing, I wondered what the hell I should do next. Weapons hadn't been included in the garage stash, not even a toolbox for bashing heads. Who'd ever created the mess in the front room carried, at minimum, a knife for slashing paintings and helpless cushions? Damn it, I hated being indecisive, but I was positive that I'd hate being stabbed even more. So I dithered, but I didn't leave. Bradley might be inside, and who'd ever done a number on the furnishings was probably long gone. Only one way to find out. "Bradley!" I yelled from the entryway. I examined the broken furniture in the next bedroom for an improvised weapon. When neither Bradley nor a guy in a ski mask appeared, I screwed up my courage and darted into the living room. Snatching a rusted fireplace poker, I yelled, "I'm coming for you, you bastard!" hoping to rattle the ski mask guy if he were actually still around. After searching the whole house, it was apparent that the home invaders were gone, but I found Bradley out cold on his bed. His head was haphazardly wrapped in a towel which was bloodstained. He was breathing. Thank God. Once I elevated his feet with a pillow, I applied ice from his freezer to the swelling on his scalp. He made small noises, but didn't wake. Too bad the phone I'd found in the bin wasn't a smartphone, or I could have searched the internet for how to deal with an unconscious person. Instead, I relied on memory. Let's see, I pinched his thumbnail to see if he responded to harmless pain. An EMT friend told me it was one way to see if someone was really unconscious. "Ow!" Bradley moaned. "Hey, wake up," I said. "How do you feel?" "Oh, man," he said. His eyes opened, and he groaned. Then, "I feel like shit. What's the—" His bleary eyes finally focused on me. They widened. "You!" I wanted to ask him what had happened, who trashed his house and beat him up, but I realized he probably had a few questions of his own. "Yeah, Bradley, it's really me. Weird, huh? Believe it or not, I'm probably more surprised than you." He tried sitting up, but I kept gentle pressure on his chest. I said, "Slow down, you might have a concussion." He settled back. "Might have? I definitely have one, because I'm talking to a hallucination. I'm real, I think. Anyway, I came over to see you. Found your house tossed and you like this." "Yeah," Bradley sighed and gingerly touched his head. He said, "You know, last time I woke up feeling like this, I eventually found out you were responsible." He was talking about the red toolbox to the head. About that. The only good thing about being knocked unconscious in the VR lab was that I didn't have to see the bodies. I woke up in a hospital. The floor seemed to drop beneath me. Oh, Jesus, Bradley, I had to stop the... What I wanted to say sounded insane. "I know, Carter. You explained it." That made no fucking sense. "Bradley, I don't remember that. I don't remember talking to you." My last memory is of returning to Ardeen.
What do you mean you don't remember?
New anxiety colored his voice.
I don't remember anything after that day in the lab.
Last thing I remember is trying to connect to a version of Ardeen I'd installed over the starting grid. The next thing I remember is waking up about an hour or so ago, lying on a garage floor.
It was Bradley's turn to look confused, more confused anyway.
He said, "How come you're not all dressed up in your, superhero costume?"
The question came so completely out of left field that I just stared at him with my mouth open.
"You know," he continued, gesturing vaguely with one hand, "when you showed up last time, a few months after you bashed me on the head, wearing that black armor made out of magic runes, it was all freaky shit. You said something about an inapposite gate being required to throw Ardeen out of temporal sync with the dimension of normal matter, whatever that means, no?
Inapposite? I don't even know what that means.
I think your concussion is talking."
"Maybe," he agreed, "but if not, then I need to tell you a few things."
"I'm listening.
Though I gotta warn you, you're not gonna like the ending."
"I already don't like the beginning."
He chuckled, then coughed.
I gave him some water.
"Hey," he said, "think you can get me a cup of coffee? A pot's already brewed."
Finding a clean cup was harder than locating the coffee maker, but I finally brought him what he wanted, my anxiety mounting all the while. Had I found Jason, Mel, and the others on the other side, after all? If so, why couldn't I remember any of it?
Bradley sipped gratefully, then said, "You were one of the bodies in the lab. You were good and dead. I attended your funeral."
Why weren't there two bodies, I suddenly wondered. The original me I'd killed, and then the body of the newly printed me that reconnected back.
Something must have changed after I'd downloaded Ardeen into the primordial network. But Bradley was still talking, so I put it out of my head.
He continued. "Then you had the nerve to show up alive and kicking a few months later.
Fuck if I didn't think I'd thrown a gasket. After I shat myself, you explained things. You said that you were the one that nearly staved my head in and explained about the alien network that swallows worlds."
I furrowed my brow trying to recall any of it, but couldn't.
"I said that?"
"You really don't remember. You said that and a whole lot more. About how you'd discovered why there was no evidence of other intelligent life in the universe and how everyone else on Earth almost learned why, too."
I shuddered. "I don't remember telling you."
"But it's true about dark energy. It's a trap. Use computers long enough to hit on the right superposition of qubits, and bam!" I smacked my palm.
"So I gathered.
But I still don't remember anything else."
He eyed me carefully. "You look like a regular person again. Normal.
Last time I saw you, it was more than just the clothes that were different. You were different. Fresh-faced, bigger than life, and you sort of came across like, I don't know how to describe it, like you just stepped out of a movie, complete with makeup and special effects. It convinced me you'd really come back from the other side."
"Yeah." The memory of printing to Earth after the initial fiasco was more like a memory of a dream than something that had actually happened. I hadn't been able to specify clothing or even oxygen. I just asked the limitless processing power of the network to copy and translate me back to atomic scale, without understanding a billionth of what was actually happening. Thankfully, it was as if the entire network was designed to do exactly that. Sufficiently advanced technology, blah, 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 magic.
Yeah.
"So, what else did Bigger Than Life Me tell you?" I asked. "That our game had installed on a dark energy, partition with nearly infinite fidelity. By doing so, it created a buffer of specified rules capable of protecting the Earth from arbitrary attack by things that lived in that network.
You called them planetivores. You were so fucking convincing, you made me believe. Of course, when a corpse shows up with a story of alternate realities and portal jumping, it lends credibility to the narrative. I remember uploading Ardeen, mostly. I didn't know if it would work. Did I say how everyone else was? You said the others weren't dead, that they were alive down in the network, Jason, Mel, Alice, and Sanders. Oh, thank God. Relief and astonishment made my hands shake. How that could be true, I could hardly imagine, but I desperately hoped Bradley was right. He took another gulp of coffee then. All of you had assumed the roles of avatars in Ardeen, you explained. Something from our old game, before we came to work with Sanders. Four of you merged with the four of the seven incarnations. Jason was war, Alice was silence, Mel was death, and Sanders was lore. You reserved the maker, the creator, for yourself. Jesus on a stick, I muttered. Sort of, except the maker has no son, remember? When we made up Ardeen's cosmology, we didn't want to replicate Christian theology except for the especially interesting bits. He laughed, weakly. I shook my head. Neither of us said anything for a while. What was there to say? Except, why am I here now with no memory of being the maker or any of this shit? You're asking me, said Bradley. Of the two of us, you're apparently the only one who remembers the last 3 years. Yeah, he said, though he didn't sound so sure. Maker Yu told me to keep tabs on quantum computer research, VR, and look for anything that might lead to a repeat of what we did, including experiments with particle colliders that reached energies of a specified level. If I saw anything like that, I was to interfere. Uh-huh, I said doubtfully. Am I here because you interfered with something? Maybe so. I've been investigating a place called Banks Digital Realty. They were looking into quantum computing? I asked. What was surprising was that more companies weren't doing the same, actually. Probably, but I must have somehow shown my hand. Three guys came by yesterday and beat the hell out of me. They wrecked my house for good measure. Probably thought they'd killed me. They didn't realize my skull is practiced in taking hard knocks. He gave me a significant look. Yeah, subtle. Who is this Banks? Bradley set his coffee down, picked it up again, and sipped.
Liza Banks,
a reformed con artist turned tech entrepreneur. For the last few months, I've been digging up everything I can about her. I must have slipped up, and she found out about me. An image of the starting grid made me swallow. My voice tight, I said, if Banks is messing around with the wrong kind of qubit, we need to... I hired a private investigator to check out the server farm where she's tweaking her hardware. The PI must have found something. You told someone else this story and he didn't have you committed? A smile. Then, she didn't have me committed. No, I didn't explain why I really put her on retainer. She thinks she's looking for exploits. I chuckled. Smart. All right. Who's this investigator? We need to talk. Chapter 9. Consultation. Catherine Manners. Kate's phone rang. Not recognizing the number, she sent the call to voicemail. If it was important, they'd leave a message. She glanced at Raoul. He was still hunched over his laptop, headphones clapped over his ears, and eyes glued to his screen. He hadn't moved since he'd plugged in the drive 3 hours ago. She'd offered him a couple of suggestions, one of which he actually took, miracle of miracles. So she waited, drinking coffee and surfing sites where security professionals discussed the latest hacks, exploits, and vulnerabilities. Unsurprisingly, sysadmins were having the same issues they always had, stupidity and human culpability. As entertaining as that was, none of the forum threads had anything to do with spontaneously melting men. She sighed and closed her browser. Maybe she should contact her client,
Despite what she told Raoul, she hadn't called Michael Bradley after the incident. She'd assumed that Jason and his strange USB stick had nothing to do with what her client wanted, but she'd been bitten by making assumptions before. Maybe Bradley knew something that might lead to another clue about Jason. Her phone rang again. This time the name on the display was Michael Bradley. The hair on her arms prickled. She swallowed, accepted the call, and said, "Hello." "Weirdly enough, I was just thinking about you. I have questions about the case." A few seconds of silence met her greeting. Then an unfamiliar voice said, "I doubt you were thinking about me, because I'm not Bradley. I'm a friend of his. Is this Catherine Manners? This is Kate. Who are you, and where's Bradley?" "Michael's hit his head. He's under the weather. I'm calling on his behalf. I'm Carter Morrison. Call me Carter." Kate's what-the-fuck radar buzzed, but she decided to see where the conversation went. "Hey, Mr. Morrison. Nice to meet you. What can I help you with? I see you're using Bradley's phone to make this call." The man chuckled. "You didn't answer when I called you on my phone, so I tried this one. I'm actually working with Bradley. How are things going with your bank investigation?" Having just faked her way into BDR, Kate was sensitive to anything that smelled like the same ploy, and this joker stank of it. She said, "As I'm sure you appreciate, Mr. Morrison, I can't discuss cases with every stranger who claims to be a friend of a client, even when that self-proclaimed friend dials in from a client's number." "That makes sense," Carter said. The sound of muffled voices came over the connection. Then someone else spoke. "Kate, this is Michael Bradley. Sorry, I should have told you before. Carter's working with me. In fact, he's the one who first identified the, issues at BDR. Carter asked me to help out, and I hired you." She imagined this Carter guy holding a gun on Bradley. "Are you all right?" Bradley replied, "Well enough. I have a whopper of a headache, though, and bright lights hurt my eyes. I hit my head." He didn't sound scared, just tired. She trusted her instinct to tell the difference, even over the phone. She said, "You hit your head?" "Stupid household accident. I need to stay off my feet for a couple of days in case I manage to concuss myself." "Ouch," she helpfully offered. Bradley said, "Anyhow, how's the investigation going? Did you find anything suspicious at BDR?" Kate chewed her lip. What should she say? "Yeah, I found something. But it wasn't an exploit or an unpatched SQL database." "What was it?" Wait, Carter wants to talk." "Miss Manners," came Carter's voice again, "you still there?" "Yeah," she said, and glanced at Raoul. His posture was terrible, but he'd come by it through years of similar sitting. With his headphones cranking Chuck Wild, he hadn't even realized she was talking to someone on the phone. "Bradley says you found something." "Yeah," she repeated, wondering how much to reveal. If she told the whole story, Carter would decide she was batshit crazy and hang up. "What?" prompted Carter. Kate said, "Nothing to do with servers. In fact, what I saw was a bit Twilight Zone-ish." She heard Carter draw a breath. Then, "Try me." "Well, here's the thing. I met a man who wasn't there." Silence, then, "What?" "Okay, listen up, Mr. Morrison, Carter. In BDR's server room, I saw someone appear out of nowhere. A man with no clothing. He was sick, said a bunch of stuff that made no sense. Then he just melted. What do you have to say about that?" Excited voices tripping over each other crackled from her handset. Apparently, Carter had put her on speaker. Finally, Carter shushed Bradley and said, "This, the man we should meet. There's no time. If people are printing across the boundary, Jesus, I need to get back into BDR, where you found this man. And just tell me what the fuck is going on, Morrison."
Liza Banks
got a courier from the other side. "Other side of what?" Carter fell silent. "Before he melted," Kate offered, "Jason said something about giving Liza a ring. Does that have anything to do with—"
"Jason? His name was Jason?" yelled Carter.
"Yeah, that was his name, but—" Carter said, "Miss Manners, meet me at BDR. Bradley and I will double your pay. Something catastrophic is happening. It's got to be stopped." Her palms felt sweaty, but she resisted the urge to rub them on her jeans.
"What specifically is happening? You're not making any sense."
"No time to explain over the phone, but if Banks has got what she wanted from her visitor, her servers are more dangerous than nuclear warheads."
Kate's eyes fastened on the USB ring still protruding from Rawls' laptop. "Banks didn't get the information Jason carried. I think I intercepted it." A man wearing a dark pea coat loitered in the parking structure where Carter said he'd be, even though she was running late. Sometimes a woman needs a bathroom break. Kate parked 5 cars down. He was alone. So was she. Raoul remained at the coffee shop. Kate had departed so abruptly he'd become suspicious, especially after she reclaimed the flash drive ring. Raoul probably hadn't believed her lame story about having to walk her dog. She didn't have a dog. He probably knew that. She didn't enjoy lying to one of her few friends, but she didn't want to pull him in any more than she already had. Besides, it was possible, despite Carter's assurance to the contrary, that she really had gone mad. Maybe Bradley had infected her, and Carter had infected Bradley. She didn't want to pass on the crazy to her friend, who was already a bit of an odd duck. Kate grabbed her pack, left her vehicle, and walked across the garage to the man in a pea coat. "Catherine Manners," he said. She extended a hand. "And you must be Carter Morrison. Call me Kate." He gave her a quick smile and squeezed her hand. He said, "Do you have Jason's flash drive?" He obviously wasn't one for small talk. "Fine," she said. "Yes, it's yours, after you tell me what you meant by servers becoming nuclear bombs." Carter frowned. "It's complicated." "Then let's talk as we go." She motioned him to walk with her. "I still haven't figured out the best way to explain what's happened. It defies regular understanding." "Remember," Kate said, "I'm the one who saw a man turn into jelly. I've got an open mind when it comes to this topic." Carter walked beside her across the parking structure, hands in his coat pockets, eyes down as if searching the cracked cement for somewhere to start. "So, this Jason guy is your friend," she offered as they ascended the stairs to level 3. The man winced, but he said, "Yeah, he and I, Bradley and a few others, were doing computer research at the university 3 years ago, I suppose. I haven't seen him since. There was an accident." "3 years? Damn, what kind of accident? Was he
irradiated
or something, and I saw the result?"
"Not exactly. Actually, I thought he was dead. If you saw Jason walking around, then a whole lot's happened that I don't know anything about."
Kate hoped Carter wasn't playing her. For someone who'd claimed to have all the answers on the phone, he was remarkably out of touch. On the other hand, he was the best thing going when it came to figuring out what happened in the server room. They reached level 5 of the structure, the one Kate was looking for. Before them, an expanse of empty parking spots fronted a blank wall and its single door bearing the BDR logo. A security camera perched above the entrance. A card reader flanked it, but she didn't advance. She just waited.
"What's wrong?" said Carter.
"Listen, I need to know a lot more than, yeah, an accident. I'm out of the loop, if you want my help." Carter pursed his lips but nodded. "And," she said, "I need to prepare my kit. I posed as an office plant care specialist to get in last time, but that won't work on the weekend." "You talk. I'll get Plan B ready." She set her pack down and rummaged for her card spoofing shim. She and Raoul had cobbled it together a year earlier. She'd been curious if a security reader could be bypassed by manipulating a reader's magnetic field to mimic a legitimate card. She'd about given up, but brought in Raoul to see what he thought, and he'd managed to make it work. Raoul had a way with electronics that sometimes seemed otherworldly. "What's that?" Carter said as she produced the ugly thing trailing wires. He crouched down next to her, eyes alight with interest. "It's our ticket into BDR. I have to calibrate it, but you're the one who's supposed to be talking." She rooted in her pack for a fresh 9-volt battery. "All right," Carter said and took a breath before beginning. "We were trying to improve computer processing power, radically improve it, in order to render realistic electronic environments on the fly, quickly enough to walk around in them."
"In them?"
"We had a bank of virtual reality rigs, VR goggles, haptic gloves, hydraulic harnesses, footplates." Kate imagined the setup. She said, "Ah, boys and their toys." "Right," he grinned, "plus a few women." She'd found a package of unopened batteries and sawed at one end with her penknife. "Well, go on." Carter said, "Peter Sanders, the lead researcher, developed a special chip. With it, he unlocked infinite processing through quantum recursion tunneling." Kate snorted with disbelief. "Yeah, that's grade-A technobabble." Carter shrugged. "Maybe we didn't understand what the hell we were messing with, that's for sure, and it bit us. We got mapped into a different network, not just as avatars, our minds transferred." Kate plugged the battery into her improvised card spoofer. The red LED blinked, indicating it was ready to go. But she wasn't. Carter wasn't making sense, which was worrisome. She said, "I don't understand." He nodded and said, "Because it doesn't make sense. I can only tell you what I know, which is what happened at the beginning. I have no idea what's happened over the last 3 years." Carter's eyes focused past hers. "Come on, you can do better than going all emo on me. Spill." "All right," Carter said. "Listen, this is what happened." Then he told her a story about a VR experiment gone wrong. Superposition chips, how dark energy was actually a trap that eventually claimed every intelligent race in the universe, and how he'd triggered that trap on Earth's behalf 3 years earlier. Chapter 10 Abrogation. Jason Cole. Jason fiddled with his belt buckle. A lesser relic of Ardeen, the red leather strap granted extra physical strength if he rotated the strap's buckle to the right, or resistance to psychic prying if the buckle was turned the opposite way. With each flip of the buckle's orientation, an electric tingle danced across Jason's stomach. Gamma said, "There's a saying about Rome burning and Nero." "Piss off," said Jason. The impact of Delta's sudden end on the other homunculi had obviously worn off. Jason's highest-grade clones made poor yes-men. He liked to pretend that he'd appreciated constructive feedback. But in truth, a lecture from a copy wasn't his favorite. Gamma said, "Not until you get off your ass, Carter Strange might be back." "Don't call him that. It's Morrison." "Whatever. Even if he's back, you can still do something about it. He hasn't reclaimed the Maker's mantle, at least not yet." "How do you know?" asked Jason. Anxiety made his voice higher than he intended. "Because we're still here, instead of being chased by umber wolves through the night vault or simply eradicated as he should have been." Jason nodded, letting his gaze wander, pretending that the old fear wasn't racing through him. They stood in one of the tallest towers of his fortress, Mageddon. But he didn't really see the landscape of Ardeen rolling away to the north, or the tumult of the Strange to the south. His mind was fixed on all the possible scenarios the future might bring. Gamma was right about one thing, at least. The Maker, the self-appointed supreme being of Ardeen, wasn't one for delaying justice, especially against rebel incarnations like Jason. The Maker could be eyeing him even now, preparing to dole out justice. "You think I should?" What, make another deal with the Kray? Asked Jason. Gamma spread his hands with a slight shrug. What else? An instance of Carter is active. Why or how doesn't matter. What matters is finding it. The thought of dealing with the Kray again was almost